how terrified I was of losing it. I have done bad things for love, bad things to stay loved. Kate is one case, Vietnam is another. More than anything, it was this desperate love craving that propelled me into a war I considered mistaken, probably evil. In college, I stood in peace vigils. I rang doorbells for Jean McCarthy, composed earnest editorials for the school newspaper. But when the draft notice arrived after graduation, the old demons went to work almost instantly. I thought about Canada. I thought about jail. But in the end, I could not bear the prospect of rejection by my family, my country, my friends, my hometown. I would risk conscience and rectitude before risking the loss of love. I have written some of this before, but I must write it again. I was a coward. I went to Vietnam. My Lai, Quang Nai Province, February 1994. Weird, but I know this place. I've been here before, literally, but also in my nightmares. 1 year after the famous massacre, Alpha Company's area of operations included the village of My Lai 4, or so it was called on American military maps. The Vietnamese call it Thuan Yen, which belongs to a larger hamlet called Tu Cung, which in turn belongs to an even larger parent village called Son Mi. But names are finally irrelevant. I'm just here. 25 years ago, knowing nothing of the homicides committed by American troops on the morning of March 16, 1968, Alpha Company walked through and around this hamlet on numerous occasions. Now, standing here with Kate, I can't recognize much. The place blends in with all the other poor, scary, beleaguered villages in this area we call Pinkville. Even so, the feel of the place is as familiar as the old stucco house of my childhood. The clay trails, the cow dung, the blank faces, the unknowns and unknowables. There is the smell of sin here. Smells of terror, too. An enduring sorrow. What happened briefly was this. At approximately 7:30 on the morning of March 16, 1968, a company of roughly 115 American soldiers were inserted by helicopter just outside the village of My Lai. They met no resistance, no enemy, no incoming fire. Still, for the next 4 hours, Charlie Company killed whatever could be killed. They killed chickens. They killed dogs and cattle. They killed people, too. Lots of people. Women, infants, teenagers, old men. The United States Army's Criminal Investigation Division compiled a list of 343 fatalities, and an independent Army inquiry, led by Lieutenant General William R. Pierce, estimated that the death count may have exceeded 400. At the Son Mi Memorial, a large tablet lists 504 names. According to Colonel William Wilson, one of the original Army investigators, the crimes visited on the inhabitants of Son Mi Village included individual and group acts of murder, rape, sodomy, maiming, assault on non-combatants, and the mistreatment and killing of detainees. The testimony of one member of Charlie Company, Salvador Lamartina, suggests the systematic, cold-blooded character of the slaughter. Question: did you obey your orders? Answer: yes, sir. Question: what were your orders? Answer: kill anything that breathed. Whether or not such instructions were ever directly issued is a matter of dispute. Either way, a good many participants would later offer the explanation that they were obeying orders, a defense explicitly prohibited by the Nuremberg Principles and the United States Army's own rules of war. Other participants would argue that the civilians of My Lai were themselves Viet Cong. A young soldier named Paul Meadlow who was responsible for numerous deaths on that bright March morning, offered this appalling testimony. Question: what did you do? Answer: I held my M16 on them. Question: why? Answer: because they might attack. Question: they were children and babies? Answer: yes. Question: and they might attack? Children and babies? Answer: they might have had a fully loaded grenade on them. The mothers might have thrown them at us. Question: babies? Answer: yes. Question: were the babies in their mother's arms? Answer: I guess so. Question: and the babies moved to attack? Answer: I expected at any moment they were about to make a counterbalance. Eventually, after a cover-up that lasted more than a year, and after the massacre made nationwide headlines, the Army's Criminal Investigation Division produced sufficient evidence to charge 30 men with war crimes. Of these, only a single soldier, First Lieutenant William Laws Calley, Jr., was ever convicted or spent time in prison. Found guilty of the premeditated murder of not less than 22 civilians, Calley was sentenced to life at hard labor. But after legal appeals and sentence reductions, his ultimate jail time amounted to 3 days in a stockade and 4.5 months in prison. In some cases, judicial action was never initiated. In other cases, charges were quietly dropped. Calley aside, only a handful of men faced formal court-martial proceedings, either for war crimes or for subsequent cover-up activities, with the end result of 5 acquittals and 4 judicially ordered dismissals. Among those acquitted was Captain Ernest Medina, who commanded Charlie Company on the morning of March 16, 1968. All this is history, dead as those dead women and kids. Even at the time, most Americans seemed to shrug it off as a cruel, nasty, inevitable consequence of war. There were numerous excuses, numerous rationalizations. Upright citizens decried even the small bit of justice secured by the conviction of Lieutenant Calley. Now, more than 25 years later, the villainy of that Saturday morning in 1968 has been pushed off to the margins of memory. In the colleges and high schools I sometimes visit, the mention of My Lai brings on null stares, a sort of puzzlement, disbelief mixed with utter ignorance. Evil has no place, it seems, in our national mythology. We erase it. We use ellipses. We salute ourselves and take pride in America the White Knight, America the Lone Ranger, America's sleek laser-guided weaponry beating up on Saddam and his legion of devils. It's beginning to rain when Kate and I sit down to talk with 2 survivors of the slaughter here. Mrs. Ha Thi Quay is a woman of 69 years. Her face is part stone, part anguish, as she describes through an interpreter the events of that day. It's hard stuff to hear. Americans came here twice before, Mrs. Quay says. Nothing bad happened. They were friendly to us. But on that day, the soldiers jumped out of their helicopters and immediately began to shoot. I prayed. I pleaded. As I take notes, I'm recalling other prayers, other pleadings. A woman saying, "No VC, no VC," while a young lieutenant pistol-whipped her without the least expression on his face, without the least sign of distress or moral uncertainty. Mad Mark, we called him. But he wasn't mad. He was numb. He'd lost himself. His gyroscope was gone. He didn't know up from down, good from bad. Mrs. Quay is crying now. I can feel Kate crying off to my side, though I don't dare look. "The Americans took us to a ditch," she said. I saw two soldiers with red faces, sunburned, and they pushed a lot of people into the ditch. I was in the ditch. I fell down, and many fell on top of me. Soldiers were shooting. I was shot in the hip. The firing went on and on. It would stop, and then start again, and then stop. Now I hear Kate crying, not loud, just a certain breathiness I've come to recognize. This will be with us forever. This will have. My notes take a turn for the worse. I lay under the dead in the ditch, she said. Around noon, when I heard no more gunfire, I came out of the ditch and saw many more. Brains, pieces of body. My house was burned. Cattle were shot. I went back to the ditch. 3 of my 4 children were killed. I'm exhausted when Mrs. Quay finishes. Partly it's the sheer magnitude of horror. Partly some hateful memories of my own. I could barely wire myself together as Mrs. Trung Thi Le, another survivor, recounts those 4 hours of murder. Out of her family of 10, 9 died that day. I fell down, Mrs. Le tells us, but I was not shot. I lay with 3 other bodies on me, all blood, did not move at all, pretended dead. Saw a newborn baby near a woman. Woman died. Infant still alive. Soldiers came up. Shot baby. Outside, the rain has let up. Kate, Eddie, and I take a walk through the hamlet. We stare at foundations where houses used to stand. We admire a harsh, angular, defiant, beautiful piece of sculpture. A monument to the murdered. Mrs. Quay accompanies us for a while. She's smiling, accommodating. Impossible, but she seems to like us. At one point, while I'm scribbling in my notebook, she pulls down her trousers. She shows Kate the scarred-over bullet hole in her hip. Kate nods and makes sounds of sympathy. What does one say? Bad day. World of hurt. Now the rain is back, much harder. I'm drenched, cold, and something else. Eddie and I stand at the ditch where maybe 50, maybe 80, maybe 100 innocent human beings perished. I watch Eddie snap his pictures. Here's the something else. I've got the guilt chills. Years ago, ignorant of the massacre, I hated this place and places much like it. 2 miles away, in an almost identical hamlet, my friend Chip was blown into his hedge of bamboo. 1 mile or so east, Roy Arnold was shot dead. I was slightly wounded. 1 little farther east, a kid named McElhaney died. Just north of here, on a rocky hillside, another kid named Slocum lost his foot to a landmine. It goes on. I despised everything. The soil, the tunnels, the paddies, the poverty, and myself. Each step was an act of the purest self-hatred and self-betrayal. And yet in truth, because truth matters, my sympathies were rarely with the Vietnamese. I was mostly terrified. I was lamenting in advance my own pitiful demise. After firefights, after friends died, there was also a great deal of anger. Black, fierce, hurting anger. The kind you want to take out on whatever presents itself. This is not to justify what occurred here. Justifications are empty and outrageous. Rather, it's to say that I more or less understand what happened on that day in March 1968. How it happened, the wickedness that soaks into your blood and heats up and starts to sizzle. I know the boil that precedes butchery. At the same time, however, the men in Alpha Company did not commit murder. We did not turn our machine guns on civilians. We did not cross that conspicuous line between rage and homicide. I know what occurred here, yes. But I also feel betrayed by a nation that so widely shrugs off barbarity, by a military judicial system that treats murderers and common soldiers as one and the same. Apparently we're all innocent, those who exercise moral restraint and those who do not, officers who control their troops and officers who do not. In a way, America has declared itself innocent. I look away for a time, and then look back. By most standards, this is not much of a ditch. A few feet deep, a few feet wide. The rain makes the greenish-brown water bubble like a thousand tiny mouths. The guilt has turned to a gray, heavy sadness. I have to take my leave, but don't know how. After a time, Kate walks up, hooks my arm, doesn't say anything, doesn't have to, leads me into a future that I know will hold misery for both of us. Different hemispheres, different scales of atrocity. I don't want it to happen. I want to tell her things and be understood and live happily ever after. I want a miracle. That's the final emotion. The terror at this ditch, the certain doom, the need for God's intervention. Cambridge, June 1994. I've been trying to perform good deeds. I bought a Father's Day card 3 days early. I made appointments for a physical exam, dental work, a smoke enders program. I go for walks every day. I work out. Draw up lists, call friends, visit lawyers, buy furniture, discharge promises, keep my eyes off the sleeping pills. The days are all right. Now the clock shows 3:55 a.m. I call nervous and listen to an automated female voice confirm the time. The nights are not all right. I write these few words, which seem useless, then get up and pull out an album of photographs from the Vietnam trip. The album was Kate's parting gift. On the cover, she inserted a snapshot that's hard to look at, but harder still to avoid. We stand on China Beach near Da Nang, side by side, happy as happy will ever be, our fingers laced in a fitted, comfortable, half-conscious way that makes me feel a gust of hope. It's a gust, though, here and gone. Numerous times over the past several days, at least a dozen, this piece has come close to hyperspace. Twice it lay at the bottom of a wastebasket. I spent my hours preparing a tape of songs for Kate, stuff that once meant things. Corny songs, some of them. Happy songs, love me songs. Today, scared stiff, I deposited the tape on her doorstep. Another gust of hope, then a whole lot of stillness. The Song Tra Hotel, Quang Yai City, February 1994. Kate's in the shower, I'm in history. I sit with a book propped up against the air conditioner, underlining sentences, sweating out my own ignorance. 25 years ago, like most other grunts in Alpha Company, I knew next to nothing about this place, Vietnam in general, Quang Yai in particular. Now I'm learning. In the years preceding the murders at My Lai, more than 70% of the villages in this province had been destroyed by airstrikes. Artillery fire, Zippo lighters, napalm, white phosphorus, bulldozers, gunships, and other such means. Roughly 40% of the population had lived in refugee camps, while civilian casualties in the area were approaching 50,000 a year. These numbers, reported by the journalist Jonathan Schell in 1967, were later confirmed as substantially correct by government investigators. Not that I need confirmation. Back in 1969, the wreckage was all around us, so common it seemed part of the geography, as natural as any mountain or river. Wreckage was the rule. Brutality was SOP. Scalded children, pistol-whipped women, burning hooches, free fire zones, body counts, indiscriminate bombing and harassment fire, villages in ash, M60 machine guns hosing down dark green tree lines and any human life behind them. In a war without aim, you tend not to aim. You close your eyes, close your heart. The consequences become hit or miss in the most literal sense. With so few military targets, with an enemy that was both of and among the population, Alpha Company began to regard Quang Yai itself as the true enemy, the physical place, the soil, and paddies. What had started for us as a weird, vicious little war soon evolved into something far beyond vicious, a hopped-up killer strain of nihilism, waste without want, aimlessness of deed mixed with aimlessness of spirit. As Shell wrote after the events at My Lai, there can be no doubt that such an atrocity was possible only because a number of other methods of killing civilians and destroying their villages had come to be the rule and not the exception in our conduct of the war. I look up from my book briefly, listen to Kate singing in the shower. A doctoral candidate at Harvard University, smart and sophisticated, but she is also fluent in joy, attuned to the pleasures and the beauties of the world. She knows the lyrics to Hotel California start to finish, while here at the air conditioner, I can barely pick out the simplest melodies of Vietnam, the most basic chords of history. It's as if I never heard the song, as if I'd gone to war in some mall or supermarket. I discovered that Quang Nai Province was home to one of Vietnam's fiercest and most recalcitrant, most zealous revolutionary movements. Independent by tradition, hardened by poverty and rural isolation, the people of Quang Nai were openly resistant to French colonialism as far back as the 19th century, and were among the first to rebel against France in the 1930s. The province remained wholly under Viet Minh control throughout the war against France. It remained under Viet Cong control, at least by night, throughout the years of war against America. Even now, in the urbane circles of Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, the people of Quang Nai are regarded as a clan of stubborn country bumpkins, coarse and insular, willfully independent, sometimes defiant of the very government they had struggled to install. Like a different country, our interpreter told us after a long, frustrating session with representative of the Quang Nai's People's Committee. These people I don't like very much, the interpreter said. Very crude, very difficult. I think you had horrible bad luck to fight them. At noon, by appointment, a Vietnamese journalist named Pham Van Duong knocks on our door. It's a secret meeting of sorts. Nothing illegal, a couple of writers, a couple of beers. But I still got the buzz of some low-level paranoia. Earlier in the day, our joint request for this interview had been denied by a stern, rather enigmatic functionary of the People's Committee. Impossible, we were told, not on the schedule. The official offered little sympathy for our interpreter's reminder that schedules are man-made, that blocks of time appeared wide open. Logic went nowhere. Bureaucratic scowls, stare into space silence. A few minutes later, just outside the provincial offices, we quietly huddled to make our own unsanctioned arrangements. Now, as Mr. Duong sits down and accepts a beer, I'm feeling the vigilant, slightly illicit anxiety of a midday drug buy. Kate locks the door. I close the drapes. Ridiculous, or almost ridiculous, but for the first 10 minutes I sit picturing prison food, listening for footsteps in the hallway. Our interpreter explains to Mr. Duong that I will happily guard his identity in any written account of this conversation. Mr. Duong snorts at the suggestion. Only a problem in Quang Nai, he says. Officials in Hanoi would be glad of our talking. They wish good relations with America. Good new things to happen. Maybe I get a medal. sell the medal, buy Marlboros. We click beer bottles. For the next 2 hours, we chat about books, careers, memories of war. I ask about My Lai. Mr. Duong looks at the wall. There's a short hesitation. The hesitation of tact, I suppose. He was 8 years old when news of the massacre reached his village nearby. He recalls great anger among his relatives and friends, disgust and sadness, but no feelings of shock or surprise. This kind of news came often, he says. We did not then know the scale of the massacre, just that Americans had been killing people, but killing was everywhere. 2 years later, Mr. Duong's brother joined the 48th Viet Cong Battalion. He was killed in 1972. My mother fainted when she heard this, he said. She was told that his body had been buried in a mass grave with 7 comrades who died in the same attack. This made it much worse for my mother. No good burial. After liberation in 1975, my mother began to look for my brother's remains. She found the mass grave 20 kilometers south of Quang Ngai City. She wished to dig, to rebury my brother, but people told her, no, don't dig. And in the beginning, she seemed to accept this. Then the Americans returned to search for their own missing, and my mother became very angry. Why them? Why not me? So she insisted we dig. We found bones, of course, many bones, mixed together. But how could she recognize my brother? How could anyone know? But we took away some bones in a box, reburied them near our house. Every day now, my mother passes by this grave. She feels better, I think. Better, at least, to tell herself, maybe. Kate looks up at me. She's silent, but she knows what I'm thinking. At that instant, a few blocks away, an American MIA search team is headquartered at the Quang Ngai government guest house. With Vietnamese assistance, this team and others like it are engaged in precisely the work of Mr. Duong's mother, digging holes, picking through bones, seeking the couple thousand Americans still listed as missing, which is splendid, and which is also utterly one-sided, a perverse and outrageous double standard. What if things were reversed? What if the Vietnamese were to ask us, or to require of us, to locate and identify each of their own MIAs? Numbers alone make it impossible. 100,000 is a conservative estimate, maybe double that, maybe triple. From my own sliver of experience, 1 year at war, one set of eyes, I can testify to the lasting anonymity of a great many Vietnamese dead. I watch napalm turn villages into ovens. I watch burials by bulldozer. I watch bodies being flung into trucks, dumped into wells, used for target practice, stacked up and burned like cordwood. Even in the abstract, I get angry at the stunning, almost cartoonish narcissism of American policy on this issue. I get angrier yet at the narcissism of an American public that embraces and breathes life into this policy. So arrogant, so ignorant, so self-righteous, so wanting in the most fundamental qualities of sympathy and fairness, and mutuality. Some of this I express aloud to Mr. Zhuang, who nods without comment. We finish off our beers. Neither of us can find much to say. Maybe we're both back in history, snagged in brothers and bones. I feel hollow. So little has changed, it seems, and so much will always be missing. Cambridge, June, 1994. June 11th, I think. I'm too tired to find a calendar. Almost 5 a.m. In another hour, it'll be 5:01. I'm on wartime, which is the time we're all on at one point or another, when fathers die, when husbands ask for divorce, when women you love are fast asleep beside men you wish were you. The tape of songs did nothing. Everything will always do nothing. Kate hurts too, I'm sure, and did not want it this way. I didn't want it either. Even so, both of us have to live in these slow-motion droplets of now, doing what we do, choosing what we choose. And in different ways, both of us are now responsible for the casualty rotting in the space between us. If there's a lesson in this, which there is not, it's very simple. You don't have to be a nom to be a nom. The Batangan Peninsula, Kwangyai Province, February 1994. The graveyard, we called it. Littered with landmines, almost completely defoliated. The spit of land jutting eastward into the South China Sea was a place Alpha Company feared the way others fear snakes or the dark or the boogeyman. We lost at least 3 men here. I couldn't begin to count the arms and legs. Today, our little caravan is accompanied by Mr. New Duk Ton, who knows this place intimately, a former captain in the 48th Viet Cong Battalion. It was the 48th that Alpha Company chased from village to village, paddy to paddy, during my entire tour in Vietnam. Chased but never found. They found us. Ambushes, sniper fire, nighttime mortar attacks. Through our interpreter, who passes along commodious paragraphs in crisp little packets, Mr. Tan speaks genially of military tactics while we make the bumpy ride out toward the Patangan. U.S. troops not hard to see, not hard to fight, he says. Much noise, much equipment, big columns, nice green uniforms. Sitting ducks, in other words, though Mr. Tan is too polite to express it this way. He explains that the United States Army was never a primary target. We went after Saigon puppet troops, what you call Arvin. If we beat them, everything collapsed. The U.S. would have nothing more to fight for. You brought many soldiers, helicopters, bombs, but we chose not to fight you except sometimes. America was not the main objective. God help us, I'm thinking, if we had been. All those casualties, all that blood and terror. Even at this moment, more than half a lifetime later, I remember the feel of a bullseye pinned to my shirt, a prickly, when-will-it-happen sensation, as if I alone had been the main objective. Meanwhile, Kate is taking her own notes, now and then asking questions through the interpreter. She's better than I am at human dynamics, more fluid and spontaneous. And after a time, she gets Mr. Tan to display a few war scars, arms, legs, hands, cheek, chest, skull, 16 wounds altogether. The American War, he says, was just one phase in his career as a soldier, which began in 1961 and encompassed combat against the South Vietnamese, Khmer Rouge, and Chinese. Talk about bad dreams. 1 year gave me more than enough to fill up the nights. My goal on the Batangan Peninsula is to show Kate one of the prettiest spots on earth. I'm looking for a lagoon, a little fishing village, an impossibly white beach along the South China Sea. First, though, Mr. Tan attends to his own agenda. We park the van in one of the inland hamlets, walk without invitation into a small house, sit down for lunch with a man named Vo Van Ba. Instantly, I'm thinking herring. Kate and Eddie have the sense to decline, to tap their stomachs and say things like, full, full, thanks, thanks. Cans are opened. The house fills up with children, nephews, nieces, babies, cousins, neighbors. There are flies, too. Many, many flies, many thousand. Mr. Tan and Mr. Ba eat lunch with their fingers, fast and hungry, chatting amiably while our interpreter does her best to put the gist of it into English. I'm listening hard, chewing hard. I gather that these two men had been comrades of a sort during the war. Mr. Ba, our host, was never a full-time soldier, never even a part-time irregular. As I understand it, he belonged to what we used to call the VC infrastructure, offering support and intelligence to Mr. Tan and his fighting troops. I lean forward, nod my head. The focus, however, is on the substance I'm swallowing. Its remarkable texture, the flies trying to get at it. For 5 years, Mr. Ba explains, he lived entirely underground with a family of eight. 5 years, he repeats. Cooking, bathing, working, sleeping. He waits for the translation, waits a bit longer, then looks at me with a pair of silvery, burned-out, cauterized, half-blind, underground eyes. You had the daylight, he says. But I had the earth. Mr. Ba turns to Mr. Tan. After a second, he chuckles. Many times I might reach up and take this man's leg. Many times. Very easy. I might just pull him down to where the war was. We're on foot now. Even at 59, Mr. Tan moves swiftly, with the grace and authority of a man who once led soldiers in combat. He does not say much. He leads us toward the ocean, toward the quaint fishing village I'm hoping to show Kate. But along the way, there is one last item Mr. Tan wishes to show me. We move down a trail through two or three adjacent hamlets, seem to circle back for a time, end up in front of another tiny house. Mr. Tan's voice goes into command tone. Two or three sharp, snapping words. A pair of boys dart into the house. No wasted time. They come out fast, carrying what's left of a man named Win Van Nu. They balance this wreckage on a low chair. Both legs are gone at the upper thigh. We shake hands. Neither of us knows what to say. There's nothing worth saying. So for a few minutes, we exchange stupidities in our different languages. No translator available to wash away the helplessness. We pose for photographs. We try for smiles. Mr. Tan does not smile. He nods to himself, maybe to me. But I get the point anyway. Here is your paradise. Here is your pretty little fishing village by the sea. 2 minutes later, we're on the beach. It is beautiful, even stunning. Kate wades out into the water. She's surrounded by kids. They giggle and splash her. She splashes back. And I stand there like an idiot, grinning, admiring the view, while Mr. Tan waits patiently in the shade. Cambridge, July 1994. Outside, it's the 4th of July. Lovely day, empty streets. Kate is where Kate is, which is elsewhere, and I am where I am, which is also elsewhere. Someday, no doubt, I'll wish happiness for myself, but for now, it's still wartime, minute to minute. Not quite 11 a.m. Already I've been out for two walks, done the laundry, written a few words, bought groceries, lifted weights, watched the 4th of July sunlight slide across my street-side balcony. And Kate? The beach, maybe? A backyard cookout? The hardest part, by far, is to make the bad pictures go away. On wartime, the world is one long horror movie, image after image. And if it's anything like Vietnam, I'm in for a lifetime of wee-hour creeps. Meanwhile, I try to plug up the leaks and carry through on some personal resolutions. For too many years, I've lived in paralysis, guilt, depression, terror, shame. And now, it's either move or die. Over the past weeks, at profound cost, I've taken actions with my life that are far too painful for any public record. But at least the limbo has ended. Starting can start. There's a point here. Vietnam, Cambridge, Paris, Neptune. These are states of mind. Minds change. Mikkei, Quangyai Province, February 1994. There is one piece of ground I wish to revisit above all others in this country. I've come prepared with a compass, a military map, grid coordinates, a stack of after-action reports recovered from a dusty box in the National Archives. We're back near Pinkville, a mile or so east of My Lai. We are utterly lost. The interpreter, the van driver, the People's Committee representative, Eddie, Kate, and me, lost. I unfold the map and place a finger on the spot I'm hoping to find. A group of villagers puzzle over it. They chatter among themselves, arguing, it seems. Then one of them points west, another north, most at the heavens. Lost. That was the Vietnam of 25 years ago. The war came at us as a blur, raw confusion, and my fear now is that I would not recognize the right spot even while standing on it. For well over an hour, we drive from place to place. We end up precisely where we started. Once more, everyone spills out of the van. The thought occurs to me that this opportunity may never come again. I find my compass, place it on the map, and look up for a geographical landmark. A low green hill rises to the west. Not much, just a hump on the horizon. I'm no trailblazer, but this works. One eye on the compass, one eye on some inner rosary. I lead our exhausted column 200 yards eastward, past a graveyard and out along a narrow paddy dike, where suddenly the world shapes itself exactly as it was shaped a quarter century ago. The curvatures, the tree lines, the precise angles and proportions. I stop there and wait for Kate. This I dreamed of giving her. This I dreamed of sharing. Our fingers lock, which happens without volition. And we stand looking out on a wide and very lovely field of rice. The sunlight gives it some gold and yellow. There's no wind at all. Before us is how peace would be defined in a dictionary for the speechless. I don't cry. I don't know what to do. At one point, I hear myself talking about what happened here so long ago, motioning out at the rice, describing chaos and horror beyond anything I would experience until a few months later. I tell her how Paige lost his lower leg, how he had to probe for McElhaney and the flooded paddy, how the gunfire went on, and how, in the course of 2 hell-on-earth hours, we took 13 casualties. I doubt Kate remembers a word. Maybe she shouldn't. But I do hope she remembers the sunlight striking that field of rice. I hope she remembers the feel of our fingers. I hope she remembers how I fell silent after a time, just looking out at the golds and yellows, joining the peace, and how, in those fine sunlit moments, which were ours, Vietnam took a little Vietnam out of me. Ho Chi Minh City, February 1994. We hate this place. Even the names, Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, a massive identity crisis. Too loud, too quiet, too alive, too dead. For all the discomforts of Quangyai Province, which were considerable, Kate and I had taken pleasure in those qualities of beauty and equanimity that must have vanished from Saigon when the first oil barge steamed into port. But we give it our best, an hour in the Chinese market district, which is like an hour in combat, 2 hours at the old presidential palace, it's tawdry and corrupt as its former inhabitants. We risk periodic excursions into streets where the American dollar remains more valuable than oxygen, of which there is precious little. Maybe we've hit some interior wall. Maybe it's the diesel heat. We visit a war crimes museum, the old American embassy, and order lunch by way of room service. American pop music blares at full volume from government loudspeakers just outside our hotel. For hours, even with earplugs, we listen to as Tears Go By and My Way. What happened to Ho Chi Minh? What happened to revolution? All we've heard comes from the Beatles. In mid-afternoon, the music ceases. We go out for a short walk, do some shopping, then retreat to the rooftop swimming pool of the Rex Hotel. It could as well be Las Vegas. We don't say so, not directly, but both Kate and I are ready to evacuate. We're humming, "We gotta get out of this place." Pretty soon, we'll be singing it over loudspeakers. For now, Kate lounges at the pool. She writes postcards. She catches me watching. She snaps pictures to show her children someday.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of The Things They Carried. Written by Tim O'Brien. Narrated by Brian Cranston. With a special bonus featurette written and read by Tim O'Brien. Executive producers: for Playtone, Tom Hanks, Gary Getzman, and Kirk Sadusky. For Audible, Greg Voynow and Chuck Weinstock. Producer, Mike Charzik. Directed by Bruce Katovich and Amil Dave. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1990 by Tim O'Brien. The Vietnam in Me. Copyright by Tim O'Brien. Production copyright 2013 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.